This is the Monday Morning Quarterback Podcast with Andy Benoit and your host, John Engel.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the MMQB Podcast with Andy Benoit. I'm John Engel at Engel's Angle on Twitter. You can follow Andy at Andy_Benoit. Remember to always subscribe if you haven't yet on iTunes. Just search MMQB Podcast. Andy, it's the last week, week 17. It feels like a playoff week. We get a little playoff fever here.
Absolutely, and it's the function of the new schedule and the NFL. That was one of the best ideas. I know I said last week that doing these division games in week 17 just shuffles some meaningless games into week 16. That there aren't very many meaningless games, and there are a lot of meaningful games that get created with this. It's week 17 is turned into. It's almost its own little playoff week. So, yeah, and we got great stuff we're going through here.
Yeah, and one of the most meaningful games we'll start off with. It might feel weird to even ask this, but the Detroit Lions, Green Bay Packers, NFC North is up for grabs. Who does this game mean the most to? Who needs a bye the most?
I think Detroit would need the bye week the most because off the top of my head, it's a lack of experience in the postseason for them. But you could easily make the argument that they shouldn't get a bye that way, that you want to keep your rhythm and keep playing. I'm not a big believer in that. I think that's true with baseball where it's a rhythm type of sport. But in football, I think a bye week is always a good thing. So I would say Detroit. I don't think Lambeau Field's – remember years ago, this was before Michael Vick went in there, Lambeau Field was considered that place you could not go and win in the postseason unless you were the Packers.
It's been that way in the regular season this year.
I don't think it's true that way anymore. I mean, you're right. It has been that way, but I think that's because the team that plays there is really good. I don't think Lambeau Field is the incredible home field advantage it used to be. Think about home field advantage this time of year and how it used to go. It was always cold. The weather and all that was a big function. But now with these heated fields, heated benches, the NFL apparel, that's all this, all the different hats and big giant coats you can wear. Even the Under Armour type of stuff, if guys want to wear that, cold is not as big a factor in football, and even the balls are taken better care of now. Cold weather does not impact football nearly as much as it did even as recently as 10 years ago. So a place like Green Bay, I don't think it's necessarily that hard to play in. But to answer your question directly, I think Detroit would want to be at home more than Green Bay would need to be at home.
Could you have imagined during the preseason that Detroit on week 17 in Lambeau would be playing for the opportunity to have a first-round bye, get home field advantage if all the pieces fall together, and win the NFC North against the Packers?
I would have to go back and look at my magazine picks. I don't remember the picks. I don't get as into the picks as people do, but my guess is I did not imagine that one. I don't think I had Detroit going to the playoffs.
The last time these two teams met, Detroit got the win 19-7 at Ford Field. How'd they get this one? What worked?
They did some great stuff defensively with two-man coverage concepts, safeties, both safeties back. They have a four-man pass rush, and that's always been the case, and they blitzed more this season. But in that game, they went with more of a four-man rush, and I think that was partly to keep eyes on Aaron Rodgers, perhaps. It doesn't hurt to double-team those Packer wide receivers, which is what they did. And their four-man pass rush actually did not generate a whole lot of pressure, but their secondary was suffocating in that game. And it's almost the inverse of every Lions-Packers matchup you'd imagine, is that Detroit secondary defeated Green Bay's receivers, but it's a great coverage concept that they used against them.
So that's Detroit baiting the Packers to run on them, right? Only 76 yards rushing yards in that game for the Packers.
And Green Bay's rushing attack, remember, started out really slow this season. And I think it's found, in fact, it's obviously found more rhythm as the season's going along.
Seahawks, Jets, Lions to start the season. Not easy teams to run against.
Great point, yeah. And so the Lions still are not an easy team to run against, though. But if they play two high safeties, it'll be interesting. That's a good point you bring up, John, because it'll be interesting to see if they do keep two high safeties back. That is an invitation for Green Bay to run the ball. And they do run the ball. Aaron Rodgers is excellent at run checks at the line of scrimmage, and that's where Eddie Lacy, a lot of his numbers come from.
And since the bye week, they've had over 100 yards of rushing in all those games. So, I mean, they've picked up that running attack a lot recently.
Lacy's playing well. And right now, it's only 2 years into his career, but the book on him seems to be he's a guy that gets stronger as the season goes along. His offensive line also improves as the season goes along. I'll tell you one more thing in the run game that Detroit needs to be concerned about. It also comes into the passing game, but at some point, Green Bay is going to put Randall Cobb in the backfield at running back and go with a four wide receiver, one tight end set. Only Cobb will be playing running back, so three receivers and Cobb. And they're going to have an answer for that. Detroit's a nickel defense. They don't play dime. So that means against that four-receiver set, they're either going to have to play dime, which they're not comfortable doing, meaning a sixth defensive back who's not usually on the field playing linebacker will have to be in that position, or they're going to have to try their luck with DeAndre Levy or Josh Bynes or Tahir Whitehead in man coverage against Cobb. Either way you look at it, that's a big factor and a big favorable matchup for Green Bay, and that's what they did against Buffalo to get hot a little bit there in the second half of that game, and they did against New England with great success. Both of those teams are man-to-man teams, so if Detroit does want to play man coverage, they're going to have a plan for when Cobb goes in the backfield.
Every single week, it seems we see a Jordy Nelson, Aaron Rodgers big play combination, especially at Lambeau. That's the fact. It's been consistent all year long. Does that two high safeties limit the big play potential?
Yes, it does, and that's why I think they'll do it again, because it's that simple. It also limits the back shoulder stuff, because if you play two high safeties and you play man-to-man under it, then that man-to-man defender is underneath the receiver. He's trailing him, so he's between the receiver and the quarterback right in the passing lane. That's what makes it such a good coverage. And that's a great way to defend the back shoulder stuff. I think they have to play that coverage in this game unless they want to run the risk of Jordy Nelson beating them, and they don't have the corners that can match up to Nelson.
And the Bills went the same direction, didn't they, with the two high safeties?
Yes, they did. I think I'd have to look at my notes one more time on that, which is baffling to me because I watched that game for 2 hours just a week ago. But I believe they did a little bit. They did more stuff with lurker concepts as well, with one of those safeties came down looking around. But basically, yes, Buffalo did not blitz Green Bay a whole lot either.
We're talking a lot about the last matchup these two teams had. Well, that was in week three. That's a long time ago. What's most different here about these two teams?
I think that Randall Cobb dimension that we went over just now. And I'm trying to think for Detroit. I don't know if there's a whole lot different. One would reason that they're more comfortable in their offense now, because it was a new offense under Lombardi and they were 3 weeks into it before. And now they're 16 games into it. So that would have to be a factor. But these teams have mostly stayed the same, which is why week three is a good blueprint, I think, for what to examine heading into this one.
That Lions defense, though, a little more inconsistent than they were in the top portion of the season.
In what ways? Do you have something to...
Well, the running attack's been there. They haven't allowed more than 90 yards on the ground since week four, but in reference to just total yardage and the passing yards they're giving up, it's been wishy-washy. Some days you give up 269 to the Bears, but then other days 360 to the Vikings. So where's the line drawn there?
Yeah, and I can't answer that. I mean, that's the kind of thing that keeps coaches up at night. But
yeah.
No matter what they've done recently, they have to go into this game with their best plan of approach for pass defense now, and I think that's going to be the two-man coverage concepts. I don't see them blitzing Green Bay a whole lot, and the only reason they might is because Aaron Rodgers, and here's another part of what's different. Aaron Rodgers is so good late in the down, and I think he's found more comfort or rhythm as the season's gone on with just extending plays and operating within structure but getting out of structure by a controlled design. So maybe that's a little different. If you don't want Rodgers holding the ball, you want to force him to get out quickly, then maybe you take a different approach. But again, I don't think they'll have to do that because they do have that four-man pass rush still.
Bengals and Steelers this week in Pittsburgh. These two teams met up just 3 weeks ago. The Steelers getting the win 42-21. Great day for Ben Roethlisberger. What do you see happening in this one?
I don't see that kind of a score. That score wasn't quite indicative of how the game went. It wasn't that kind of a blowout. I mean, there were at the end it was, but they had the 94-yard touchdown to Bryant. They had that aberrational Dalton fumble on the read option play, some swing plays, which always can happen, but you can't bank on that when you analyze a game going in. So for this one, I think the approaches will be similar on both accounts. Pittsburgh ran the ball effectively in that game. Cincinnati's coverage was not bad. They kept safeties back. They didn't blitz a whole lot, which has been their approach, not over the years, but over the last several weeks, ever since Vontaze Burfict left the lineup. I could see them doing the same thing again. Cincinnati's going to have an answer for Le'Veon Bell, though. He beat them way too many ways last time, not just on the counters and the powers, but also through the passing game.
I'm interested that you said that the Pittsburgh's coverage was held up fine, but A.J. Green, 11
receptions.
Did I say
Pittsburgh's? I meant Cincinnati's coverage held up fine.
Maybe I messed that up.
Well, let's talk about Pittsburgh's coverage, though.
Might as well.
That was a big factor in the game, and that's been a big factor lately. They've got cornerbacks you can throw at. I mean, they just do. Ike Taylor's been banged up most of the season. I don't even know if he'll play this weekend.
Forearm injury.
Yeah, well, and then he's had, I think he has a shoulder or something as it is now once he got back from that. But he got torched on a deep ball by Green, just absolutely torched off the line of scrimmage. We know the problems with Cortez Allen. He's not even in the lineup anymore. His replacement, Antoine Blake, got targeted often by Kansas City. It was apparent that Kansas City went in planning to throw at Blake. And I'm sure they've done it. I can't remember the last time Kansas City went in planning to throw at any cornerback. I mean, that's a between the numbers passing team, and they adjusted what they did and went outside a little more just to go against Blake. And then we've talked about William Gay before. I'm not a big William Gay fan. And so he plays with a big cushion is why. And so what's Cincinnati going to do to put those corners in one-on-one situations? That's going to be key to this game, just like it was last time.
Well, and the Steelers have allowed over 300 passing yards in two of the last four games. So it's a flawed defense that's going up against an attack that is pretty consistent. You know, A.J. Green's the guy week to week.
He is the guy week to week. And so I don't think you can come up with a great, the other thing is Polamalu, I don't know how healthy he is this week. He missed last week. So especially when you factor that in, I don't think you can come up with a great plan for just taking them away through coverage. I think you have to be the aggressors and force this. Really, it's an unathletic Bengals offensive line by NFL standards. I think it's a decent line. But as like the Chargers showed last postseason, it was a big deal. Those linemen up front, they don't move east and west particularly well. So I think Pittsburgh needs to be more the aggressor. They're always the aggressor, but that they have to get something out of their pass rush and force those linemen to move and force Dalton off his spot. He's not as good, no quarterback. Well, some are, but Roethlisberger's good when you get him off his spot, so I have to take that back. But Dalton's not as good when you force him off the spot, when you take him out of rhythm. And you do that through the pass rush. The Steelers are not going to line up and do what, like we just talked about Detroit doing, and take away through coverage.
And then that could certainly limit A.J. Green's ability to help that offense. And the Steelers have a similar weapon. The Bengals are going to have the same kind of challenge with Antonio Brown. How do you think that shakes out?
Well, he's a little different in that you can't just keep the ball out of his hands because they throw so many screens and swing passes to him. That's why he's got the 5 reception in every game record. I don't know what he's up to now, but it's like 30-something games with 5 catches. He'll get whatever 30-something plus one in this one. They'll get him his touches. He's where you don't want to get beat by Brown. If you're going into this game and you're Paul Gunther, the D coordinator, you have to tell your guys and your assistant coaches, we can't let Antonio Brown beat us 12 to 17 yards downfield, because those 12 to 17 yarders can also turn into 35-yarders, and they keep drives alive. And that's what Pittsburgh really lives on, their running game and the deep intermediate passing game.
Even when you limit or keep Antonio Brown in front of you, if he gets the ball, he's electric from then on out. It seems like we saw that a lot last week, too. Get him the ball with a couple yards of space, and he's gone.
Yeah, you'll have to tackle well. And Cincinnati's they're kind of an inconsistent tackling team at times. They're above-average defense, so overall they're not a bad tackling team, but for them to play up to their standards, there have been cases where we haven't seen them tackle completely well at times. You have to tackle Bell and Brown. Those two guys will get the ball on the perimeter, and it's up to your corner. And that's why they're so dangerous, because now you're making cornerbacks be the primary tacklers, and then linebackers and safeties are the help defenders. Those corners have to make hits.
If you're a defensive coordinator, who do you want to see the least, A.J. Green or Antonio Brown?
Oh, I'm going to wiggle out of the question a little bit.
Oh,
by
don't
saying,
do that. No, you can't.
Well, can you guess how I'm going to wiggle out?
You always have your ways.
This is an intelligent wiggle out.
Okay,
it depends on my personnel. It depends on who I have. You don't like it.
That's the go-to answer for any pick'em. It depends on who I have around him. It depends who
my
quarterback
is. I mean, what am I, a zone team? Am I a man team? How much do my safeties run? Green's more dangerous downfield. Brown's more dangerous underneath in a nutshell. And I think anyone can look and see that. If you're forcing me to answer the question, I would tell you I'm more concerned about A.J. Green because he has because of his size, he has an ability to make contested catches. So even when we play him well, we might still lose. Versus Brown, he doesn't, you know, it's harder for him at his size.
He doesn't play like he's 5'10", though.
I don't think there's any play he's limited in. Look, you know? I'll take Antonio Brown over almost anybody in the league. I don't know if I'd do it over A.J. Green, though.
Okay, that's fair enough. Panthers at Falcons this week. It's easy to make fun of the NFC South, but the winner of this game will be hosting a playoff game, and whoever has to travel to face them, it's not a bye week. I mean, it's not an easy win. It's the playoffs in the NFL. Let's go at this one from a little bit different angle than you're hearing everywhere else. So without saying neither of them deserves to be in the playoffs. Which team is more deserving between the Panthers and the Falcons?
Carolina has, they're finishing strong. So, I mean, they're quietly, they're on a 3-game winning streak. So,
yeah,
if you're
who
into
known?
That, and yeah, and they've had some adversity with the quarterback and all that. If you're into that kind of thing, finishing strong, I guess it'd be them. I think Atlanta's the better team, though. And Atlanta's defense, it's still been up and down, but it's quietly finished fairly strong in the second half of the season as well. They just held the Saints to 14 points. And if you take out that Green Bay Packers game where they got torched at Lambeau on Monday night, I think since the bye week, Atlanta's giving up less than 21 points a game through their defense. Their offense had some turnovers that got returned against them, so the points have still been there, like I'm thinking like the Steeler game. But Atlanta's defense has started to find itself, and that's something that that's a game changer in terms of how you look at the Falcons.
I would also want to choose a team that's more dependent on a good passing game like the Falcons than a Panthers team that's so dependent on a good running attack.
I would too. I like that point because the thinking's always been, well, running the ball, you control the game that way. But that was back before they changed the rules, and now you can control the game probably even more through the passing game because what happens when you run, we saw this with the Jets on the Monday night game against Miami, you keep the game artificially close. You might score points, but it takes you so many snaps to score those points, and you have fewer possessions, you run fewer plays. Now, so does your opponent, but a field goal by the opponent keeps the game within one score at all times versus if you can – there's nothing more damaging than killing a team through the air on big plays. And anything – Brian Billick's done a great – he used to do a great stat where explosive plays, runs of 12-plus yards and passes of 20-plus yards, plus turnovers, that will almost always tell you who the best teams in the NFL are. And the biggest stat out of those three groups, probably turnovers, but passing numbers are trump running numbers by far.
Numbers-wise, this Panthers team has improved a lot defensively since the bye week. What's changed with that team that you've seen on film?
Their secondary's been better. Norman at cornerback has stabilized. Now, I've learned to not fall for that bait too much in the past 2 years.
You mean like week to week or just with
him?
Yeah,
like you don't fall in love with Josh Norman. He might be stable this week. So he's been stable the last 3 weeks.
Things you've learned this week from the podcast. Don't fall in love
with Josh Norman. But he has played better the last several weeks. And then Benay Bainwickery has also played really well. They're a fifth-round rookie. And he's moved outside ever since they got rid of Antoine Kayson. And so the secondary has been better, and that was their great weakness before. And with the secondary better, also those linebackers have played up to their usual speed. So the Panthers' defense has come back to its identity a little bit. It's still not where it was a year ago, though, when they had Greg Hardy.
The most interesting play in this game is going to be Falcons offense against that improved Panthers defense. Who gets the responsibility of taking on Julio Jones?
Whoever is lined up across from him, because they don't move those corners around.
Whoever's least lucky, I think that's the point.
Well, except that person might get safety help, and the other one won't. And Carolina does a lot of single high zone coverage. Which doesn't mean that they're only going to have the safety double team one guy. In fact, that single high safety almost always stays in center field and doesn't go double team anybody, which means your double team help is going to come from other areas. And I would think like something like the in-breaking routes that Atlanta's been known to do, I think Carolina will be able to take those away because their underneath defenders play with more depth than others because they have the speed. They can make up for it. So I think where Atlanta will attack Carolina, where this game will be decided, is on the edges. Hook routes, back shoulder routes, deep fly go routes along the sidelines, those kind of things. And that's going to be tough against Julio Jones, whoever has him, because I'm not, Bainwickery, Norman, they're playing better. That's nice. It's Julio Jones.
Okay, then how about the other side of the ball with Cam Newton and that Panthers offense?
The running game, that's what they've leaned on with Jonathan Stewart, an improved interior offensive line. And also when Newton is in there, they have a triple option element to it because Mike Tolbert, the fullback, can run the ball. They'll bring a wide receiver into the backfield as a pitch option. And then there's Newton, of course, coupled with whoever's at running back. And so that's a lot of dimensions to account for as a defender. And what Carolina can do is hurt you by making you think. Mike Shula can do it. He does a good job with run designs that go in multiple ways and forcing the linebackers to think rather than react.
I think the best part about looking at the league from an outside perspective and not having really a favorite team are these spoiler games late in the season, week 16, week 17. Washington played the spoiler in the NFC East last week, beating the Eagles 27-24. What do they do against the Cowboys this week to be effective like they were when they eliminated the Eagles last week?
They have to generate big plays. They did that against – look, they didn't play great against Philadelphia. I mean, Zach Ertz hurt them a lot. Macklin had a few plays. I know they gave up some crossing routes to Jordan Matthews from the slot. All the things that you wouldn't – and McCoy and Sproles also ran well. So all the things that you wouldn't want to have happen to you against Philadelphia, you could say happened to them. But what they also did was beat those pass protectors in one-on-one situations at times. They capitalized on turnover opportunities, and those are the things that swing games. And that's how spoilers happen. Washington's not going to line up and just outplay Dallas for four quarters. They're going to have to generate some kind of swing in the game with a big play that alters field position drastically.
So what does Washington have to stop then that the Colts weren't able to when they got thumped by the Cowboys last week, 42-7?
Well, that one just got away from Indianapolis. I mean, we'll talk more about that on the Indianapolis side because I think that was an Indianapolis-oriented game. Dallas played great offensively, obviously. DeMarco Murray did not have a ton of yards. Tony Romo was red hot in that game. And Washington's always done – you know, Jim Haslett's always done a pretty good job of scheming against Romo, and we saw them already earlier in the Monday night game, and that was a closely contested battle as well in Dallas, you recall, and they got pressure on Romo at the end of that game too.
Did your Jim Haslett – haters come after you after this one, or they stay home, stay away from their keyboards?
I haven't heard from him yet because I haven't been on Twitter. I don't get on Twitter till you know midweek or something.
Did you see what Jerry Jones said this week, trying to stir the pot again, saying that Tony Romo is in fact in this MVP conversation?
Yeah, and I think some of his players backed him up, didn't he?
I think DeMarco Murray said the same thing.
Really? Because Murray, we'd be taking votes from Murray then. Yeah. I get the sentiment. I understand that's nice. I mean, that's great that they feel that way. Obviously, it's not true. There's been other quarterbacks that have played better. Romo's not necessarily even the most valuable guy in his team. We've talked all season, well, more early in the season, but it hasn't changed because of this running game. Romo's become somewhat of a complimentary player in Dallas, and that's not a bad thing. That's a great thing, and he's a smart quarterback that can manage the game well when he has the right settings around him. Now, he doesn't always manage it well when it's all on his back, but this year he's had
literally
the guys...
and figuratively.
Oh, thank you. But he's had the guys around him this year, and he's really played the way that you want Romo playing.
So then grade his performance this season. It is one of his best years, 70% completion percentage, 32 touchdowns, 8 picks. Where do you put him?
I was going to say B+, but after your numbers, I'll go A-. I didn't know they were quite that
nice.
Impressive. The thing with Romo is his arm strength has declined a little bit, which might be part of the reason he's a complimentary player. That and just it makes sense to play that way because you can run the ball so effectively. But I'm not so sure if Dallas were to get down a lot of points, and they did once this year, if I recall, against St. Louis. It wasn't a bad D, but it was early in the year. The Rams weren't quite the Rams yet. I don't know if I can't remember if they've got down big or not the rest. I don't see this being a team that can necessarily come back.
Well, they were down against the Eagles, right? And then there was the comeback from the Eagles, comeback from the Cowboys.
Yeah, but I mean down where like you're having to throw the ball. Like down by 15 or more points or something.
You're more forcing the deep play.
Yeah, just if you put Dallas in a pass-only situation, I think they can do that here and there. And I think they can do it really well here and there, in fact. I think they can kill you. But if you force them like what we saw San Francisco do to San Diego at the end Saturday night where Rivers threw the ball 25 plays in a row, if Romo ever had to do something like that or even just 10, 15 plays in a row, it's a different Cowboys offense, and I'm not, you know, I don't know what we see there. Their pass protection has been excellent all year, though.
Let's wrap up Washington for the week. Rumors say that RG3 and Jay Gruden will both be back next season. What do you think about that?
I think we have all offseason that we're going to talk about that one.
Yeah, it'll be our top topic.
Can't we see that becoming every single – why don't we just save that for – We're going to do this podcast in February and March and April and May and June
and
July.
We'll need some summer topics.
Yeah. We'll save it for every other week then.
RG3 didn't look too bad last week, though.
Yeah, no, he didn't. I didn't see the coach's film on that one, so I don't know if he was leaving receivers open on the field or not. I thought there were times where I watched a game on TV. I thought there were times where he looked decisive in the pocket and showed a willingness to operate within the pocket. And he also looked a little better when he chose to run. So there's stuff to be encouraged about with RG3. We saw that also the previous week against the Giants. But again, the previous week against the Giants, he also gave up. He also had 7 sacks against them, and a lot of that was him not pulling the trigger. So I'd have to see the all-22.
San Diego at Kansas City. Chargers are in a spot that a lot of teams wish they were in at week 17. If you win, you're in. While the Chiefs would need a win plus losses by both the Ravens and the Texans, the Chargers were in that situation last year. They barely beat the Chiefs that were playing mostly backups. What's the key for them heading into this one?
The key for them is winning against man coverage, which they were able to do against San Francisco at least once Parrish Cox went out. And also, San Diego's a big-time check-down offense, and that might sound disparaging, but it's not. Rivers is the best in the league at getting to his check-down and understanding how to use it. And when you watch the film, you see that they even design their check-downs extremely well. A lot of times it's intertwined with a shallow crossing route and also mixed into the protection scheme, which all teams do, but few teams execute it with the precision and consistency that San Diego does. So they have to win on that checkdown game. It's an extension of their rushing attack.
That's really interesting to me because when I think checkdown, from not being the film expert that you are, I wouldn't think that you game plan for the checkdown, that it's not a component of the mix that's going on.
Well, everything's game planned to a certain degree.
But moral of the story, checkdown isn't always just last resort.
It is, but the last resort can be strategic as well. I'll give you a great example. In fact, it happened against the Chiefs at the end of last year. Bear with me because there's a lot of dimension to this play. And I spent all offseason looking into this and talking to people about it, and I finally got the answers from the right people. It was the Donald Brown catch that went about 50-something yards against the Chiefs. And there was a big contention at NFL Films in the film room, but half the sides believed that it was just a check down, and half the sides believed it was a called pass play that merely looked like a check down. And I had a chance, actually, is when I interviewed Andrew Luck. And I clarified with him, and he said it was a hybrid type of thing, where it was a check down, but the check down was designed to also exploit the coverage concept that the Chiefs had. And that really changed the way I looked at check down passes. And really the whole journey of trying to find the answer to the Brown checkdown was where they knew that Kansas City had certain tendencies out of their dime sub package, or may have been their nickel. I think it was their dime because they played dime so much. But they had certain tendencies out of their sub packages of how they picked up guys in man coverage. And so the Colts merely exploited that. I bring that up because San Diego, they would do that kind of thing. That's something Mike McCoy and Phillip Rivers would notice, and they would go after. And when you're a man-to-man team like the Chiefs tend to be, you can really skew it because you only have one receiver to manipulate, one defender. All the other defenders are running with your receivers, so you only have to confuse one guy to get your check down open. And with your routes downfield, if that one guy is confused and your check down's open, there's going to be a ton of room for him to run. I think that's going to be a big, big key in this game is minimizing the damage of the check down. And Kansas City has athletes to do it. When you play dime, you have faster guys on the field. So they should be able to compete with the running backs, but they cannot get confused.
But if anyone can handle all of those moving parts, it's Phillip Rivers.
And question.
He's struggling with that bulging disc injury. How much does that concern you?
I mean,
he's an Ironman. 143 straight starts.
And I guess only two missed practices that whole time from what people have told me, what these Charger fans like to tell you.
They're crazy.
Bulging disc, that's bad. I don't know. I'm not a medical guy. I know that he looked pretty good against San Francisco. There were some throws that were uncharacteristically off, but not many. And what he did at the end of that game, where you would think that if he has back problems, it would become worse as the game progressed, especially because you, if nothing else, if you're getting a shot, and I don't know if he is, but if you are getting a shot, each snap you take is a longer time that's passed since your shot. So the medicine's wearing off.
I think he got one earlier this month. I think that's what I read.
Okay. Well, whatever he's getting, he looked fine down the stretch. So I just going off of what I've seen, I think we have to say he's okay.
On Kansas City's side, were you surprised at all that Jamaal Charles only got 9 carries last week?
Yes, I was big time surprised because the Steelers, it's not like these are the Steelers of the mid-90s or early 2000s that you cannot run the ball against.
Scary defense.
Yeah, I mean, they can be a formidable run defense, but they should not be making you one-dimensional. And Alex Smith threw the ball 41 times in that game, and Jamaal Charles got 9 touches on the ground. That doesn't work. And watching the offense and the way it was structured, it was clear that DeAnthony Thomas was the go-to guy in the passing game on the perimeter, screen concepts, misdirection. He was playing the role that Charles often played last year and that Dexter McCluster played at times to a much lesser degree. But bottom line, DeAnthony Thomas was taking touches away from Jamal Charles, and that's not how you want to be doing that. The approach needs to be DeAnthony Thomas gets touches in addition to Jamal Charles, who should be getting at least 20 a game.
The last time these two teams played, the Chiefs put up 154 rushing yards on them. So do you see a much more significant push for the run if you're Kansas City?
It would make sense because they had a good formula in that game. First of all, San Diego helped them out by missing some tackles, which they also, by the way, did last week against San Francisco. The formula was a lot of read option stuff, and it tended to be Jamal Charles was a read option threat to the outside, and when Nile Davis was in, it was a read option to the inside. But either way, it was a good multi-dimensional rushing attack. And I could see them doing that again because I think they Andy Reid ought to be coming out and saying for the fifth or sixth time this year, I regret not giving the ball to Jamal Charles, because that's what they have to do. It's not like they have a dynamic passing game.
Since week five, the Chargers have been allowing a lot of points to. Phillip Rivers is having to take over games late. How long do you think that's sustainable? Does that worry you about the Chargers that so many points are being given up?
Well, I mean, I guess the way you say it, if it's since week five, then
I mean,
yes.
Yeah, you take out the game against the Raiders, they only gave up six, but they only scored 13, so.
Yeah. Well, give us some highlights few weeks back, because we saw what happened in San Francisco, and there were some big plays in that one that that put extra points on the board.
Okay,
and
I'll just go in order, most recent to oldest. 22 allowed to the Broncos, you allowed 23 to the Patriots, 33 to the Ravens, 24 to the Rams, skipping the Raiders game. You have bye week, then Dolphins. You gave up 37 and 35 to the Broncos. I mean, there's lots of points.
Let me argue the other side then, if I can.
Go for it.
That they were bad heading into their bye week. Were they not? I believe they hit like a 3-game losing streak or something heading into the bye.
3 games, yep.
And that Miami one was the last one. And so let's say that it's a different team post bye week. It doesn't work like that, but in some ways it kind of does. Let's say the different team post bye week. What I heard you say is that they gave up, 22 to Denver, 23 to New England?
Yep.
If they'd gone into those games thinking they would give up that many, they would have taken that in a heartbeat. Those are the two best offenses in the AFC, and they held them both to under 24 points. It just happened that those two offenses also have very good defenses themselves. I'm not too worried about San Diego's. The only thing that might concern me is that their pass rush, Dwight Freeney hasn't showed up quite as much this season, and I wonder if age is catching up to him a little bit. We also haven't seen quite as many blitz concepts from Pagano. I'm sure he has reasons for that. But no, I'm not worried about the San Diego defense. It's not great, but I'm not worried about it.
Sticking with games that have major playoff implications, first off, what happened to the Ravens last week? That was terrible.
I haven't seen the film on that one yet.
Joe Flacco was bad.
Oh,
I'll
I know he was.
That.
He was 4 of 21 at one point, I think, and 21 out of 50 or whatever it was to end the game. But what stood out to me, I do read the box scores on Sunday night, Monday morning. What stood out to me was that Baltimore didn't have much of a rushing attack there.
33 total rushing yards.
And they didn't fall behind big. I mean, it was a close game, right? So it's not like they fell behind and had to abandon the run. Their running game has tailed off the last few weeks, and it was evident. I've seen every other game they have had on film this year. And I'll watch this game eventually, but what I've seen on film the last few weeks that's different from what I saw earlier is their rushing attack doesn't control the tempo of games anymore. It's that zone running game. It hasn't been quite as dynamic, and that's a problem. That's obviously a problem. It's hurting them now. It hurt them in this game, and that's a passing attack that's built around the running game because of what they do with play action in Kubiak's offense.
And if the running game isn't there, should they get into the playoffs? This isn't a team that can solely rely on that passing attack.
I don't think it is because of that reason. They're synced. And it's not just like people think play action is, you fake the run and now they believe that there's a run because you run well and then they actually throw it. That's not how it works. Play action is about synchronizing your passing concepts to your running concepts. And so you want your run plays, your pass plays to look like your run plays. That's why you do zone stretches. Because when you do a zone stretch and you go to the perimeter, for the first 1.5 seconds of that play, there's no possible way for the defense to know if it's a pass or a run because the ball's not handed off or thrown yet. So you need that dimension. And why the running game is important for that part of it is because, for one, it's a rhythm thing. Your offensive line has to play the same every down, no matter if it's run or pass. But for two, you want to be ahead in the down and distance. If you fall to 3rd and 9, you're not running those stretch zone action things. Even at 2nd and 9, you might be hesitant to run all your play action stuff. So Baltimore is a team that needs to stay ahead in the down and distance in order to be consistent. And they can win if they're behind because Flacco has a big arm, but that's not the formula that's going to be sustainable for them.
A couple of weeks ago, I didn't think this was possible, but a win plus losses by the Ravens and Chargers puts Houston in the postseason. Andy, why aren't more people talking about what Bill O'Brien has done in Houston?
I don't know. A lot of the focus is on J.J. Watt, and O'Brien is an offensive coach, so maybe he gets overlooked in that way, but people also are not talking about Romeo Crennel. Another reason it might be is because Houston's never really jumped out big this year. I guess they were 3-1 early in the season, but then they lost 3 in a row, and they've kind of gone back and forth, and they've hovered around .500 a lot. So it hasn't been necessarily a threatening Houston team. And then you also couple in the quarterbacking issues. But to me, the problems at quarterback makes what O'Brien's done all the more impressive.
Just like Bruce Arians with his little quarterback carousel. They're giving him all the credit for being able to do it with Ryan Lindley, everyone.
Yeah, and Arians, they did get hot, and they played with the lead in the standings, so to speak, and they've been up there, and Houston is not. So it's a JV version of the Cardinals almost. But the Texans, yeah, that's quietly, they're right in this playoff contention here.
What's your first impression of Case Keenum?
Well, I would have to go back. I remember watching him. I think, did he play last year or 2 years ago?
Last year he made 8 starts.
Okay, so it was last year. It all just kind of blurs together.
Yeah.
I remember he's very mobile compared to what they had before in last year. I think he's a guy you have to get him on the move in order to make him comfortable because there were two things that stood out about him now that I'm thinking more. The later in the down it got, the worse he got. And also the later in the game it got, the worse he got. And that tells me there were tendencies on him that teams found very easy to exploit. Probably staring down receivers, maybe some mechanical issues, the way he reads the field would factor in. I don't know. He's the guy this week, right?
Yes.
Okay. And the other thing to keep in mind is Case Keenum is familiar to the franchise, but not to this offense and not to Bill O'Brien. I don't know if he has any experience in O'Brien's system.
So then what about Blake Bortles? Almost done with his rookie season. What's your report card grade on him?
C-. I mean, he's a rookie, and that C- isn't the worst thing. I think there's upside there. I can see why he was the number 3 pick. He does every game. He has a few throws that looks like what a number 3 pick's throws would look like. He's also good on the move. He's athletic. He has the size. I would be happy with what I have in Bortles in terms of the type of clay that I'm molding with, but I want to mold him a whole lot more than I have if I'm Jacksonville.
He has 5 multi-interception games. Is there a decision-making problem with Bortles, or is that just a rookie learning curve?
It's a rookie learning curve. I mean, there have been a lot of rookies that have interceptions. We forget that. It's easy to forget that now, but in some ways, I would even argue that it's a good thing he had the interceptions because he's willing to pull the trigger and read the field and play at the deep intermediate levels, and he trusts his arm strength. You have to assume as he gets more experience, he'll clean up his misreads and understand the field and what he's looking at more.
We'll stick in the AFC South. The Colts, is there any reason to worry given what happened last week?
Well, anytime you get blown out this late in the year, there could be reason to worry. Keep in mind, Indianapolis got blown out twice last season to the Rams and the Cardinals, and the Cowboys game, you know, I wrote before that Indianapolis would exploit Dallas's cover 3 defense. And, of course, I got a lot of tweets Monday morning calling me an idiot and all that kind of stuff. And I'm sure there were comments on the article as well. It's easy to say that. But if you think about Dallas never played cover 3 against them because the Colts never got on track. They ran 9 plays in their first 3 possessions. So 3 consecutive 3 and outs to begin the game. They ran the ball, kept it on the ground on 4 of those 9 plays. They had the worst running game in the NFL, and I don't know how long it's going to take them to understand that. And so when they got on the field for their 10th play, they were down 28-0. So the game plan changes now. Dallas doesn't have to play cover 3 because they can keep 2 safeties back. They could even play some cushion at times if they wanted. They can pin their ears back. It just was a game that got away from them. I don't know if you worry that much. The only thing you worry about is your rushing attack stinks, but it stunk all year long. Just called different plays.
Well, it seemed like after that failed fake punt, it was just done for Indy. It was like, okay, the Cowboys are just going to run away with this one.
that happens every so often. I could see Indy bouncing back just as readily this week. I mean, maybe it's not important this week, but in the playoffs, Indy's not going to get blown out again like that.
How about another end of season quarterback assessment? Andrew Luck, you wrote that you thought he'd be the best quarterback in football by the end of the year. You wrote that in September. So it's September. We make a lot of bold claims. How do you feel about it now?
I feel good about it. I don't think it's true. I don't believe he's the best QB in the NFL right now. I think it's Aaron Rodgers is the best. I'm not sure Luck has even passed Brady and Manning yet. I would say he hasn't. I'd leave him at number four, maybe five with the Roethlisberger thing. Phillip Rivers. I'd take Luck over Phillip Rivers still right now.
Okay.
But I feel fine about Luck. I think Luck has improved this season. I think he's played up to the standard, an extremely high standard. Other guys have had their best years. I don't regret any part of writing what I wrote before the season, and it's nice to have the conversation about Luck at least steering in this direction because he needs to be talked about as the best in the league. That's the class he was born into when he entered this NFL.
When you're in the driver's seat heading into the playoffs, it's easy to say, okay, a coach needs to rest some players and take it easy in week 17, but Bill Belichick does not go that route. He plays all of his guys, doesn't rest anyone. Even if it is a meaningless, per se, final regular season game, do you agree with that approach?
This is an old debate, and it goes back to, you know, for my lifetime, the heated part was this Belichick issue because he paid a price for that in Week 17 in 2010 when Welker hurt his knee.
The Bills are competitive.
Yeah, I mean, every NFL team is competitive, though. You're going to want to come out and fight.
Well, I mean, this isn't going to be a blowout. That's what I mean, is that the Bills can hang with anyone this
season. So Belichick might not be able to pull his starters at halftime or anything? I mean,
well, I'm saying he doesn't even have the choice to rest them.
You think he has to compete?
I think he should.
It's a personal matter of personal preference. I mean, there are big-time football people, like, again, Bill Polian, who totally agrees with the idea of resting the guys. And then there are other big-time people, like Bill Belichick, who believe you play them, you prepare each week. I think you're inclined to play your guys, especially because you have the bye week. And what you certainly don't want to change your preparation during the week, and this is probably Bill Belichick's thinking. His thinking is, these are professionals. We have a routine that we do. The season is designed to go this long. We have trained for the season to go this long, just like Tom Brady in that SI article, where his workouts, regardless of what they do in the postseason, he goes all the way through the Super Bowl. They really are built on a regimen. So Belichick thinks, we have that regimen, let's keep it in place, and so we want to have our starters prepare with starter reps and practice all week long. And then you get to the game and you feel like you have to keep the starters in because the backups didn't get any reps during the week. My guess is that's how he views it. It's not about winning the game as much, although I'm sure that's very important to them. It's about maintaining the professional routine that they've established.
Drastic swing for the Bills, too. If they had not lost to Oakland last week, they could be playing for a playoff spot themselves. What went on in Oakland?
Got to win them all, right?
They're
all important. Kyle Orton was inconsistent with his ball placement. I think it's true that Buffalo's a quarterback away, and that's not a great spot to be in because you don't just go out and find a quarterback. The defense was not quite where it was. You know, when Marcell Dareus went out with the knee, I don't know if he had some, I think it was a knee injury. Yeah, he had a knee. I watched this game. He had a knee injury. That run defense changed. They were vulnerable up the middle all of a sudden, and Oakland took advantage of that.
That Oakland team that beat Buffalo is in Denver this week. The Broncos won't be the number one seed in the AFC like they were last year. Is this a big deal, or do you kind of look past this a bit?
It's not a non-deal because they're going to at some point if they want to get to where they're trying to go, they're going to have to go likely, I guess it'd be to Foxborough. That's where it'll be in the AFC Championship. It's a little bit of a big deal, but it's not the end of the world because the weather is similar in both of those stadiums. And as we talked about earlier, I don't think weather is quite as big a deal as it was years ago.
We made a big deal about all the acquisitions that Denver made in the offseason. How do you feel about DeMarcus Ware, Aqib Talib, T.J. Ward, and what John Elway did this offseason?
Like, what's the final verdict on that?
Did it work?
Yeah, I think it did. I think it's successful. I mean, all those guys have played well. Ware's gotten a little quiet lately. Have you noticed that? Or maybe you don't notice because he's quiet. But it feels like we're hearing a little bit less from him. And maybe Von Miller, too.
I still think he played above expectations. What him and Miller have been together at times has been fantastic to watch.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And Denver doesn't blitz a whole lot anymore. They used to blitz. And they could if they wanted to blitz because they have the man-to-man defenders, which I guess is the testament to Talib. Chris Harris has had a good year, but Talib's also been equally great on the other end of the field. So I think Tlaib was worth it. I think Ware was worth it because now they're not having to blitz. And I like the way TJ Ward has played. He has covered tight ends. And he's not great at it, but we've talked before, just the ability of a strong safety to cover tight ends, sometimes that's enough. The ability to be competitive there. And he's also a great hitter in the box.
He's so aggressive.
Yeah, he gives an attitude to that defense. And his box presence, I think, has been even more important given all the injuries and turnover that they've had at the inside linebacker position.
Rams, Seahawks. If Seattle beats the Rams this week, they clinch the West, will be a number one seed in the NFC, barring a Packers-Lions tie. Make the case for them being the best team heading into the playoffs. I don't think it's that hard to make.
Well, first of all, it's annoying that we have to say barring a tie. I understand why we have to say
it. Yeah, there's a few of these scenarios barring a tie.
Yeah, I know. I'm not mad at you. Make the case for them being the team to beat heading into the playoffs. We know about the defense. Here's my case. I'm falling in love with Russell Wilson, and I never thought I'd say that. I never thought I'd say that because he does. You know how I feel. I'm a pocket passing quarterback lover, and that's you climb the pocket, you read your progressions, you make throws with bodies around you. Yeah, the footwork, all that stuff. Russell Wilson does almost none of that, but when he moves, it's not just randomized football like it is for all these other mobile QBs. There's a structure and a deliberateness to it. And I've never seen anything like it. The NFL's never seen anything like this guy. He is totally unique, and he's very accurate throwing from any platform, anywhere on the field. So that's my case for Seattle, is that Russell Wilson might not be the best QB in the league, but he very well could be the hardest QB to play against.
We saw that against the Cardinals, too. He'll get flushed out to his left, and you think he's just going to try to run like he's done so many times, and then out of nowhere, off balance, a flick pass 15, 20 yards down the field to Luke Wilson.
And Seattle's starting to build their offense around these flush-out plays. I mean, they know what they have in Russell Wilson. They know what he can do. And so there's a reason that he has guys to throw to when he runs out and runs around.
But they're planning. It's not planning broken plays. It's all part of the design now. It's crazy to even think
about.
The
defense, but from the structure of the defense, the way defenses are built, it does become a broken play, and you're right. It's a planned broken play, or it's a planned whatever we're going to call it. It's unstructured play, which to the defense is broken because defenses are built on the idea of a quarterback being within the pocket. That's what blitzes are designed for. There's not, and I've talked with a lot of coaches about this because I'm always curious what you do with these mobile QBs. There's not a blitz in the league other than maybe a slot blitz early in the on a first or second down where you're also defending the read option as part of the blitz. Other than maybe a slot blitz, there's not a blitz in the league designed for a quarterback outside of the pocket. It's all designed on the idea and the premise that the quarterback is inside the pocket.
I'm not part of this Russell Wilson religion yet. I'm getting there.
Mm-hmm.
But with Russell Wilson, it has to be noted that he's the only one that's been able to win sustainably with the running and the mobility outside of the pocket. The other guys he came up with, all about the same age, they're starting to wither away. You don't see RG3 in these conversations like, who's better, Wilson or RG3?
Or Kaepernick, or Cam Newton. Yeah. Or Michael Vick years ago. Michael Vick never did what these guys are doing now.
He keeps doing it.
The counter to that is none of those guys had this Seattle defense, which might be the best over a 2 or 3 year stretch here, and it's going to be more than that, even 4 or 5 years, because these guys are young. We might look back and say this was the best this was equal with the 2000 Ravens and probably the best since the 85 Bears. I have never saw those Bears, but from what I hear, people liked them.
We've mentioned it a couple of times, but how big has Bobby Wagner, Cam Chancellor being healthy during this 5-game winning streak been for them?
Enormous, but I also go back to Byron Maxwell. I think he's equally as important as those three because Maxwell gave them, when he came back, he's so lanky and strong, he gives them the ability to compress the field from the outside. And when you do that, that's what makes Chancellor and Wagner play so fast because they have less field to worry about, less offensive weapons to concern themselves with. If you can, that's Seattle's game right there. Richard Sherman and someone else, and this someone else has been Byron Maxwell, compressing the field vertically from the outside and making it a smaller zone area for those inside defenders to handle.
Now onto the team that gave up 596 total yards of offense to the Seahawks. The Cardinals are on the road against San Francisco 49ers, kind of hobbling into the playoffs. All season long, their defense has been that way. They've been strong. They've been stingy. But now it's starting to crumble a bit. Did that defense get exposed at all by giving up 35 points?
Maybe in that Arizona was, or excuse me, Seattle was able to exploit some specific man-to-man matchups, and mainly with our guy Larry Foote there.
Seems like post-podcast appearance guys aren't doing so
Kareem hot. Jackson, at least in man coverage. Kareem Jackson didn't do well after he came on our podcast, and Larry Foote had a bad game in man coverage last week. Larry Foote's not a man-to-man defender, though, and if Arizona wants to rectify that, they can just blitz him more often. You can't blitz him every down, though, and Seattle had a great feel for what looks. Russell Wilson really knew what defensive looks indicated that Foote would be in coverage, and he attacked it. I don't know if there's a whole lot else to worry about. We've talked about Arizona before. They looked bad against Denver as well, the other Super Bowl team from last year.
Bad in a different way, though.
I would say bad in the same way in that they gave – how in a different way?
I'm saying this week it wasn't that the Cardinals were getting beat by burner wide receivers like Denver put up against them.
Right, they got beat by Russell Wilson scrambling and
Marshawn
some
big plays.
The Marshawn Lynch, let's put that one to the side. That's one of the best runs I've ever seen. And let's put that to the side for a second. What beat Arizona in that Denver game was guys getting burned to man coverage. And what I think beat them in this game last Sunday night was also man coverage. It just didn't look like that. Like when Russell Wilson scrambled, he had two big runs right up the middle, a 55-yarder and a 22-yarder, I think it was. Both of those came against man coverage. And when you're in man-to-man, those alleys in the middle, if they open up, they're going to be big and wide because the defenders have ran with the receivers and are elsewhere right now. And they also have their backs to the quarterback and might not even know he's running until he's 15 yards downfield. So that's, you're getting beaten man coverage when you do that still. And then as we talked about Luke Wilson, his catches came against Foote in man coverage. Arizona, if they lose in man coverage, they'll lose every game they play. They just don't lose in man coverage a whole lot.
On the offensive side, do you agree with Bruce Arians going with Logan Thomas over Ryan Lindley this week?
I do, because if Lindley doesn't read the field with sharpness, and if he's not aggressive in it and all that stuff, then what's the point of having him in there? He has no raw talent that he's going to beat you with. So he has to win with his mind. And he's shown that he can't do that. So I would go Logan Thomas because at least he presents opportunities for chances to win on plays that you maybe wouldn't have won with through structure and design.
Jim Harbaugh's been stealing the headlines for the last couple of weeks. But Bruce Arians is coming into this game too. Two really good coaches. Is Arians your coach of the year?
Yeah. Is he yours?
I would say so.
I would hope so. I mean, not for you. I mean,
you quiz me with this stuff all the time. You're like, oh, okay, good thing you watched
that
Jags-Titans game.
Oh, well, yeah, I did say that. Now we got to explain what you're talking about. Off air a few days ago, we went to dinner, and I asked, did you watch Jacksonville-Tennessee the night before? And you said you did.
I don't think you would have let me eat if I didn't.
And I said, I'm good. I'm proud of you because we have to watch this game. It's a good game, too.
I think
we both enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. We have to watch. All these games count.
Arians.
Yeah, okay, Arians. Coach of the Year. And I wasn't trying to demean. I hope so, Coach of the Year, meaning I hope other people feel the same way and he gets the award. I thought he deserved it last year, too. So he's going to get it 2 out of 3 years now. Who's your top? Who's 3 or 4? I mean, who else?
Ooh.
If he doesn't win, who would get it? Who would take it from? I think Belichick's always in there. They're not going to give it to him, though, this year. But
you got to always put Belichick in there. I mean, people are going to point at Pete Carroll, too. They were supposed to be limited because of pieces moving around after a Super Bowl.
Yeah.
We talked about Bill O'Brien.
I don't know. What about
Bruce has the only name flying around my head all season.
No one's mentioned Jim Caldwell in Detroit, and the Lions are in contention for the number one seed, and they changed their whole structure on both sides of the ball, and who oversaw that? Who hired those assistants? Who's been the man in charge?
Wins the North, he has to at least be one or two, right?
I don't think anyone's paying attention to him in that regard.
The Lions,
I think
haven't
more
won
people would vote for McCarthy than Caldwell, which I would understand. I think McCarthy's another guy.
When was the last time the Lions won their division? That's like 30 years?
I don't know. Yeah,
I think it's something like 33 years or something.
Portsville
like
or whatever they were, right?
Caldwell's got to be in this thing.
Yeah, I think so. He's not going to be, though, because we haven't heard his name yet. And the voters already kind of have their minds made up heading into Week 17.
We talked about Bruce Arians. What about defensive coordinator Todd Bowles? Do you think he's going to be started to get poached for these head coaching gigs that are coming up?
Oh,
as soon as this offseason, maybe?
People will look at him, no doubt about it. You know, some guys, and I don't know if Bowles is like this at all. I don't know Todd Bowles. Some guys are better coordinators than head coaches. Dick LeBeau is a great example. He wasn't a very good head coach, or at least wasn't a successful one. I don't know how he was as a head coach.
But Rex Ryan.
He wasn't. You think Rex Ryan's a better coordinator than head coach?
I think he's destined to be a good defensive coordinator for a team.
I think his brother's a better coordinator than head coach, and
Robbie.
That's why he's kept the job, yeah. But what I asked Steve Spagnuolo this, because Spagnuolo, remember, he was a big-time coordinator, and he was sought after and regarded as the next great thing in coaching, and it didn't work out one iota there in St. Louis. And I asked him what percent of the job is similar and what's different, because when you're a head coach, you're doing different things. You're not doing the same stuff as a coordinator. You're focusing on both sides of the ball. You're focusing on travel arrangements, all
personnel.
This stuff with the media. Yeah, all these little things. I said, what percent of it's based on – I didn't ask what's different. I'm sorry. I asked him how much of it is football and how much of it is something else. I think he said it's 90% football, 10% something else, or he maybe said 70-30, something like that. But on what was different, is that's where he said it was 70-30. 70% is the same, but as a head coach, you do 30% of different stuff than you normally would have done. That's a weird 30%. We don't know who's good and bad at that 30%. Jim Caldwell, he's probably great at the 30%. People didn't think he was all that good at the 70%. So he hired coordinators, and they do the work. Now, you know, I don't know if you take Todd Bowles, how good is he at the 30%? I don't know that. That's a tough thing for owners to find out, too.
You got to take a chance.
That's why you do the job interviews for 4 or 5 hours if you're an owner. But, you know, Bowles might be more valuable as a coordinator than a head coach. If I'm an owner, I might say I want to pay him $4 million a year to be a coordinator rather than $5 million a year to be a head coach.
Yeah, keep him paired with Bruce Arians as long as you can if you're Arizona. Two other coaches who have been in the news lately, one likely to be fired after this game and the other reportedly coming back in 2015. That'd be Miami's Joe Philbin. His Dolphins are hosting the Jets in what could be Rex Ryan's last game in green and white, Andy. What's Ryan's future in the NFL? Is he going to be a great defensive coordinator just preached to you?
Yeah, according to John Engel, he's a defensive coordinator.
That's right.
Now. I think he'll get a look as the head coach from somewhere. He'll get looked at. He ought to be. I mean, he went to back-to-back championship games doing things his way with a rookie quarterback who we've learned is not bursting with talent. So why wouldn't Rex Ryan? The only reason you wouldn't consider interviewing him if you're an owner is, one, you just don't believe in such defensive-oriented football, which chances are no owner is that entrenched in their beliefs because owners don't know football in that way. Or two is you just don't want that kind of personality being the face of your team. And I could understand that one. I don't think it's a bad personality Ryan has, but it's so unique and so pronounced that you'd have to consider that if you want that or not.
Joe Philbin and Rex Ryan have to be complete opposites personality-wise.
Yeah, even everything about him's off. I mean, Philbin's got to weigh, a third of what Rex Ryan weighs? I mean, he just looks, you know, he's skinny. Ryan's gotten skinnier, but the way they carry themselves, Ryan is a big, jovial, fat guy. Philbin's a slender, quiet guy. Yeah, I get that. I don't think any of that stuff matters that much, but owners do.
Could Philbin possibly be a better coordinator than he is a head coach?
I don't, again, it's
just
it's,
another one of those
so,
what ifs.
Yeah, it's such a hard thing because the film doesn't show how coaches interact with their players behind the scenes. And I know Philbin was on Hard Knocks. Trust me. I trust me on this. Hard Knocks does not show how those interactions go either. That is a highly – it's a great show. I'm not speaking bad of NFL
films.
Oh, I
love it. I eat it up.
It's a highly, highly edited show. So we don't know anything about how these guys behave behind the scenes and how they do their job. We just can't speak to that.
Did you really just ruin that for me? I mean, you don't have
Does
to.
That ruin
you
it?
Don't have to shatter the glass that it's really a reality show that's fake, just like all the other.
Well, it's not
shows.
Fake. It's because the guys are doing real stuff. I'm just, they're very selective. HBO doesn't make the final call about what goes on the air. NFL Films does.
It's no coincidence that we have a bunch of hot seats and coaching in a row here. We've saved that for the non-playoff teams for last. We've talked about Mark Trestman a lot on this show lately. You like him? Think he should come back? You don't feel the same about defensive coordinator Mel Tucker, though?
Nothing personal against Tucker. I just think it's time for a schematic change, and Tucker's a cover two guy or Tampa two or zone based D coordinator. You have to do something different in Chicago on defense.
Is it a personnel thing, or are you going to keep pointing at Tucker? Because could anyone do better with what they have there right now?
I think you have to try. I think you have to, because we know what's happening now is not working. And I don't think it's how Tucker doesn't get through to the guys. I think it's a schematic issue. I think you need, and I looking at their guys on their roster and who's under contract next year, they've got money tied up in some guys. They're not getting a whole lot of new players next season. So they're going to be back with largely the same cast. I think you have to try something different with them.
If they went the Zimmer route, per se, and found a new coordinator to lead a new scheme, what do you think the best scheme is to put in there in Chicago?
Well, I like the Zimmer. You know, you said Zimmer
route. I mean, they're going to Minnesota. Might as well explore
it. Right, and that's probably what made that pop in your head a little bit. I like man-to-man coverage. I like that.
I've noticed. I've gotten that feel over 17 weeks.
But it's easy to say, well, go play man-to-man. You have to have the right corners for that. And as I said, their personnel's not necessarily coming back. So, you know, like a John Pagano type of guy could be really good for them. That would be a pretty drastic change, though, because we're talking about altering your defensive linemen. They've drafted defensive tackles early in recent years, and I know a dumb thing they did, quite frankly, was paid Jared Allen and Lamar Houston a bunch of money. I didn't like those signings from the start, and it turned out every bit as bad as I thought they would. But why that's really dumb is now your money's tied up there. You've drafted young defensive tackles, so you almost have to remain a 4-3 defense. And if you have zone corners on the outside, now you kind of they might be committed to what they've done.
Eagles Giants this week. It seems like that Eagles elimination just came out of nowhere. It happened all of a sudden. Three straight losses heading into this one. What happened with the Eagles? Where'd that meltdown start?
Well,
just blame it on Mark Sanchez.
Sanchez for another week, and then they'll have to find a new backup QB. The running game wasn't ever as consistent as it was last season. They've been inconsistent there. Pass protection broke down most recently in that Washington game, and so their offensive line also didn't win quite the same way. That's half the football offense right there, running game, offensive line. I mean, now it's on to the passing game, and they had an injury at quarterback, so they had some change there. I don't think that hurt them. I think they were fine with Sanchez in there, but only fine, nothing more than fine. It just wasn't as consistent of a team this year on offense.
Not a great season for the Giants, but three straight wins heading into this one. Is this a reason to be encouraged as a G-Men fan heading into next year?
I think so, because for one, it eliminates, and I don't think we need to eliminate it because I think two Super Bowl rings ought to do it, but it eliminates the concern about whether Coughlin has his hand on the locker room still, whether these guys are quote-unquote playing for him. It's impressive. I'm always impressed when a bad record team, especially a big market one that's had success before, when they finish strong like that, that is encouraging.
Are there any specific points within the offense that you think they need to improve on going into next season, or is the offense relatively intact?
They need to get more stable at the number two and three wide receiver positions. Reuben Randall and Parker, and we don't know what Victor Cruz's health will be like. So there's that. The offensive, what goes hand in hand with that is the offense's pass protection also needs to become sounder.
We'll do our last report card here. Give Ben McAdoo a report card. Give him a grade for his first grade as offensive coordinator, or first year as New York Giants offensive coordinator.
That's a tough one, and I'm going to pass on it by saying a C. No, I'm going to say a C. A C, which people think, oh, it's not good. A C is average. It's dead average. I give him a C, and I'm curious to see how it goes in year two.
We'll finish with two of the most disappointing teams in football this season. The Saints lost their last five games at home this year. They're now on the road against Tampa Bay. Have we seen the demise of the Sean Payton, Drew Brees, Saints mystique?
Yes. I'll say yes.
Oh.
What?
It's hard to swallow.
Oh, like you can't take, like that's bad news to you or something?
It just feels weird to not be all in on Drew Brees and Sean Payton.
Well, you can be all in. I mean, they lost five games at home this year, and some of them were, in fact, a lot of them were in really bad fashion. So when you say the mystique of them, I say, yeah, that does ruin the mystique. Now, you're not going to change quarterback or head coach. That would be foolish of them. I don't think you do that, because as long as you have those guys, you can go into the season feeling like and being a contender. But something happened. I mean, when New Orleans starts getting blown out at home, doesn't that have to raise eyebrows?
Especially when we once said it was impossible to beat Drew Brees in the Dome.
Exactly. And not only did they get beat, they've been beaten bad. So, and it's the offense was not as good this year. They don't have a ton of weapons on that offense.
Jimmy Colston's not a number one anymore.
No, he never was. He never was because he can't create his own separation. He's a guy, that's why he's a seventh round pick.
He's huge.
He's huge, and he works great in their system. He goes down the seam, so he's often working against – they do a lot of trip sets with him at inside. So he works against linebackers a lot. And he's great down the seams at beating linebackers. Really, he's like a super dynamic flex tight end almost. And And Graham's that same way, and Graham didn't have his best year either. So yeah, the Saints have some stuff to work on. I think they need another weapon or two around those guys. And they really missed, you know, they had it in Darren Sproles. That was a great fill-in-the-blank miscellaneous guy. They really missed him this year.
For the Bucs, even though it's only been 1 year, do you stick with Lovie Smith? I mean, they were your pick to win the division.
Thank God.
And they let you down.
Thank you, yeah. Well, and I picked New Orleans to also finish 11-5.
Oh, I picked New Orleans to win the Super Bowl.
Everybody picked New Orleans. Yeah, I hope the other people are getting tweeted at, too.
Like all of the film style, all the analysts?
Everyone missed on the NFC South this year. Everyone's below 500. We all missed.
Yeah, I guess if the division winner is getting into the playoffs with a losing record, I think we all kind of suffered from this one.
We did. As far as Lovie Smith goes, I think it's kind of a Mel Tucker situation, frankly. What concerns me is they have the players, though, to play zone defense like Smith wants. And clearly it did not work out this year. But I think I would bring Smith back, give him another chance at that. You don't just, especially a veteran coach like that with a track record, you don't just cast that aside. Let him try to do what he wants to do. Their problems are on offense. We have all offseason to talk about it. In a nutshell, quarterback issues with no speed, bad offensive line, and no running game.
Andy, we made it through the regular season. Next week we'll have playoffs to talk about once again. If you haven't followed Andy yet on Twitter, @Andy_Benoit, or myself, @InglesAngle, remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Make it easy on yourself. Get the podcast. Every morning it comes out. Just search MMQB Podcast in your iTunes search. From Andy, I'm John. We'll see you next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.